Well, shalom out of our students. Welcome to our next session in the first regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. This is session 4, and we'll finish up our introductory material in this session. So let's review where we were last session. Last session, we began with a discussion of the fact that the Jewish people have experienced sojourns and returns to the land throughout our history. The first sojourn out of the land was the sojourn in Egypt around 2000 BC by Abraham and his family. It was very short. We went into Egypt and we returned to the land very quickly, and this sojourn was limited to Egypt. The next time out of the land was our Egyptian slavery. We left the land in following the command of God, and lived in the land of Egypt to avoid the famine. But a new Pharaoh then arose in Egypt and came to the throne and enslaved the Jewish people. So we experienced the Egyptian slavery for about 400 years. Then we returned to our land in 1406 BC under Joshua. And this sojourn and return was limited to Egypt. The next exile was the Babylonian exile in 605 BC. The Babylonians kicked us out of the land for 70 years, and we were regathered to the land in 536 under Ezra and Nehemiah. This exile was limited to the Middle East, was more extensive. Following this exile comes the Roman exile that began in 70 AD and was completed by 135 AD. We were kicked out of the land by Rome, and we wandered all over the face of the earth for about 1,800 years. And then we were regathered for judgment in 1948, according to Ezekiel 20, verses 33 through 38. And the unique aspect of this exile is that it is worldwide in nature, and that's a very important aspect. The next sojourn out of the land will be the tribulation exile in the midpoint of the tribulation, Matthew 24, where we will experience a very, very intense but short exile out of the land. Then we'll be regathered for blessing during the second coming, and again, this will be of worldwide character. The next subject we talk about was the Russian coalition's invasion of Israel. And here is little Israel on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea, and Russia to the far north of Israel, as far north as you can go. And I do believe Russia will be the leader of the coalition that brings a number of armies into Israel to destroy her. And she can come into Israel from the north through Lebanon, or from the east through Syria or Jordan. We don't know exactly which country will be the portal for this army, but into Israel they will come, and God will allow them to get to the mountains of Israel. The mountains of Israel are the central spine of the nation, the Judean hills. And the object of this invasion appears to be Jerusalem. However, God will stop this invasion in its tracks. He will destroy the Russian coalition's invasion of Israel on the mountains of Judea, on the mountains of Israel. We also talked about the two worldwide regatherings. The first worldwide regathering is a regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. That judgment will be the tribulation period of Ezekiel 20, verses 33 through 38. And we're experiencing that first worldwide regathering right now. The second worldwide regathering will be in faith, in preparation for blessing, kingdom blessings, in Isaiah 11, verses 11 and 12. Then I diagrammed Ezekiel 20, 33 through 38 for you, hopefully to make it a little clearer. The first regathering, Ezekiel says, is from wrath, and that would be a reference to the Nazi Holocaust. We're gathered from wrath because the Nazi Holocaust provided the foundation and the beginning and the impetus for the State of Israel. So we were gathered from wrath, but we're also gathered by the first regathering for wrath. That's in preparation for the Tribulation Holocaust. And when the Tribulation Holocaust has run its course, then the second regathering will occur and we'll experience our national salvation, restoration, and kingdom blessings. So I hope that chart makes Ezekiel 20 a little clearer. I then had to take issue with some comments that a prominent evangelical has made on his website during a question and answer period. And I make these comments simply because John MacArthur is a very influential evangelical, and and his views get a lot of hearing. So I feel I need to speak maybe perhaps a different perspective than what he shares. I began with this comment by Dr. MacArthur. He stated, nothing specifically going on in Israel right now is connected to biblical prophecy. A rather astounding statement to me, because I responded on a number of points. The third point being, presently we are witnessing the first worldwide regathering. It's a regathering in unbelief in preparation for tribulation judgment. Certainly that's connected to Bible prophecy. And here are your prophecies. Ezekiel 20, 33 through 38, 22, 17 through 22, and Zephaniah 2, 1 and 2. It's definitely connected with Bible prophecy. I also stated that the events we are witnessing today are setting the stage for the Russian coalition's invasion of Israel in Ezekiel 38 and 39. That's definitely connected with Bible prophecy. Dr. MacArthur went on to say, the fact that Israel exists is certainly prophetic. The fact that they're in their land is setting the stage. Well, I'm happy that he agrees that Israel in the land is setting the stage, but this is a very confusing comment to me. Didn't he just contradict himself? He said, nothing going on right now is connected to Bible prophecy, yet Israel in the land is certainly prophetic. Sounds to me like he has contradicted himself. He states later on, I am not pro-national Israel, I am pro-prophetic Israel. Do you see the difference there? And frankly, I do not. This is his most confusing statement. National Israel and prophetic Israel are one and the same. You can't separate them. He goes on to say, so we will not go so far as to say that God is going to protect Israel because he has some obligation. And that astounded me, because God has obligated himself to protect Israel on the basis of the Abrahamic and land covenants. If he does not fulfill those covenants with Israel, his reputation is sullied. He has obligated himself to protect Israel. Now, on this issue, I'd recommend that you buy and read the book, Has the Church Replaced Israel? By Michael J. Vlach. It will cover this issue very well. Again, recommended additional resources for you. Has the Church Replaced Israel? Dr. MacArthur continues, so Israel is in an unprotected position before God until they turn to their Messiah. Then they become completely protected. Again, I'm kind of astounded at this statement. And I respond, if Israel is unprotected, why in the world did she survive the War of Independence of 1948 and the Yom Kippur War of 1973? She should have been wiped out in those two wars. In addition, God will deliver Israel from the War of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and that is before they become believers. MacArthur puts the war in the tribulation, but that's still before Israel experiences her national regeneration, before faith in Yeshua. Well, after that exchange, we then talked about the characteristics of the final regathering, the basis for the final regathering, the land covenant, Deuteronomy 29 and 30. The final regathering is prophesied in Isaiah 11, 11 through 12, 6. The final regathering includes every Jewish person from all over the world, which is not true today. The final regathering will be permanent, which is not true today. We will suffer one more exile out of the land. The final regathering, during the final regathering, Israel will be a blessing to the world, and Israel is blessing the world today, but it's not not to the extent that Israel will be blessing the world in the final regathering. Israel is being blessed in preparation for Ezekiel 38 and 39. And during the final regathering, we'll be reunited as a nation, and that is true today as well. and during the final regathering, we will be the center of Gentile attention, but that's for good. Today, Israel is a center of Gentile attention for criticism. She's the most reviled nation on the face of the planet. During the final regathering, Gentiles will aid the regathering, and Gentiles have aided the first regathering, but that's not to the extent that it'll be understood or experienced during the final regathering. And the final regathering, angels will also aid the regathering, and that is not true today. During the final regathering, every Jewish person will be righteous. That is not true today. And during the final regathering, millennial Mount Zion will be in place and the millennial temple will be erected. Neither of those factors are in play today. And I'd like you to take a more detailed look at this by buying Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. Again, another very valuable resource that I would recommend that you purchase for more details on this subject. We then finished up by looking at the blessings of the Mosaic Covenant. The blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant are covered in Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 through 14. Well, actually, Deuteronomy 28, the whole chapter. And the parallel passage, Leviticus 26, the whole chapter. The blessings in verses 1 through 14 of Deuteronomy 28 and 1 through 13 of Leviticus 26. All right, so then we come to the new material. We're going to look at the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant, and I have a suggested resource for you, the Messianic Bible Study Collection, manuscript number 132, The Blessings and Cursings, The Outworking of the Mosaic Covenant in Leviticus 26, again available through REL Ministries. I would really suggest you purchase that manuscript. It'll be a great aid as you study this subject. All right, we're in chapter 26 of Leviticus. So let's start with the blessing side of the coin, and we'll start with verses 1 and 2, which teach that obedience is required to experience the blessings. You shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land and bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Well, this command not to worship idols has been broken already. Here's a picture of four ladies up on the Golan Heights dancing and worshiping before this little clay idol. And the caption read, Potter Daphne Zuckerman replicated a clay figurine thought to be that of a goddess. For about half an hour they danced while the leader recited a prayer, thanking the goddess, not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but the goddess for the forces of life, fertility, and peace. And that was that appeared in Biblical Archaeology Review in 2001. So we can say, at least in 2001, idol worship was back in the land. Flagrant idol worship was back in the land. And James says in his book that you break one law, you've broken the whole law. James 2, 10 and 11. For whoever keeps the whole law yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but do commit murder, you've become a transgressor of the law. This is because the law is like a chain. Each link is an individual law. And so when one link, one law is broken, the whole chain is broken. So obedience is required in verses 1 and 2. And of course, unfortunately, idol worship is back in the land. Then as we go to verses 3 and 4, the conditional nature of blessing is brought out. If, there's the conditional nature, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains. See, if you obey, then I will give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. So one of the blessings of obedience is adequate rainfall. But unfortunately, Israel has been suffering year after year, time after time, of drought rather than abundant rains. So we're not experiencing this blessing today either. Let's move on to verse 5. In verses 5 through 10, Israel is promised prosperity, power, security, and peace. Indeed, your threshing will last you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. I shall also grant peace in the land, so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I shall also eliminate harmful beasts from the land, and no sword will pass through your land. But you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. Five of you will chase 100, 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. So I will turn toward you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will confirm my covenant with you. You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new. And so this state of security is hardly present in Israel today either. Instead, Israel is harassed within and without by her borders. In 2002, for example, the mayor of Jerusalem stated this about the terrorism that stalks the land. He said, "In Israel, the war is being fought not 5,000 miles, but 500 feet from the bedrooms of our children, and we do not feel we have to apologize for defending ourselves. And the situation still exists." Here's some recent stories from the Times of Israel in March 2019. Father says it's a miracle the family survived the Gaza rocket that leveled their home. Daniel Wolf describes mad dash to shelter moments before massive explosion and silence, dust, and screaming. And also, in April 2019, in the Times of Israel, the section called The Blogs by Uri Pilichowski, Uri writes, "Dear American left-wing Jews," that's the title of his blog, "Israelis live under an incomprehensible stress if not lived personally." In other words, the point there is, you guys in America cannot understand the stress that we are under because you are not here living it out personally. You know, Israelis live under an incomprehensible stress if not lived personally. And now he describes it. The thought of a rocket landing, a bomb exploding, or a surprise stabbing creates unending pressure. Israelis know that American Jews care about their safety and security, but to Israelis, safety and security is a living beast that hovers over them at all times. This is not a distant concern to the Israelis. Safety and security is crucial to their daily life. So in Leviticus 26, prosperity, power, security, and peace are promised, but they're not being experienced by the modern state of Israel today. So let's move on to verses 11 through 13. And the greatest blessing of all is promised for obedience, God's presence. "Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves. And I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect." So God's presence is a great blessing, but God is not walking in the midst of Israel today. He will walk in the midst of Israel during the Messianic Kingdom. In other words, Israel is not experiencing the blessings of the covenant today. Rather, she is experiencing the curses of the covenant. So now we want to move to the curse side of the coin as we get to verses 14 through 17. Now the curses of the covenant are also found in Deuteronomy 28 as well. And we'll take a quick jaunt over to Deuteronomy 28 in a minute or two. But we're currently in Leviticus 26, so let's stay in Leviticus 26. Let's continue on through the chapter. In verses 14 through 17, we're promised that if we do not obey, we will experience sickness, harassment, and insecurity. Leviticus 26, 14 through 17. "But if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commandments, if instead you reject my statutes, and if your soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. I will appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption, and fever that will waste away the eyes and cause the soul to pine away. Also, you will sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies will eat it up. And I will set my foot against you so that you will be struck down before your enemies, and those who hate you will rule over you, and you will flee when no one is pursuing you." And so that's the first cycle of curses: sickness, harassment, and insecurity in the land. Then as we move to verses 18 through 20, the second cycle of curses is mentioned: drought and famine. "If also after these things you do not obey," you do not obey me, again, this is curses for disobedience, "if after these things you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins." And that phrase, seven times more, is just an indicator that I am going to ratchet up the punishment. I'm going to turn the screws down tighter. Your discipline is going to get more severe. "I will also break down your pride of power. I will also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. Your strength will be spent uselessly, for your land will not yield its produce, and the trees of the land will not yield their fruit." And the truth of this is brought out by as article by the Water Authority in a recent article in the Jerusalem Post. It was entitled Severe Drought from 2015 through 2035. And of course, drought is one of the curses of the covenant. We read in that article, Israel must prepare for the possibility of a severe drought period that is expected to begin within a few years, the Water Authority warned on Monday. Models from the authority's hydrological services have predicted that Israel will face a long and difficult drought from 2015 through 2035. Now, this is 2019 when I'm recording this video, so we've just begun to enter into this period, which will be even more exceptional than the country's previous two drought periods, 2004 through 2010 and 1999 to 2002. Or 2004 and 2010, 1999 through 2002. And these droughts are increasing in severity. The past droughts, 1999 to 2000 to 2002, lasted 4 years. Then there was a little bit of a break. And then 2004 to 2010, the next drought period was 7 years, almost twice as long. And now there's been a short break. And now the projected drought is from 2015 through 2035, that would make it 20 years in length. So it does appear that God is increasing the discipline against Israel because Israel's not responding in obedience. Now, I was at Tabcha in 2009 and took a picture on the beach of the Sea of Galilee of the church there. And I was on the beach, but this yellow line is the water line. This is where the water should be if the lake is full. The water should be at that level. And here is a picture of the same location when the lake is full. You can see the water levels right up where I indicated it should be. Where was I standing to take that picture? I was standing right there. I should have been underwater. But Israel is suffering drought. And she hasn't suffered famine yet, but one of the curses of the covenant that she is suffering is drought. In verses 21 through 22, we come to the third cycle of curses, which is danger from wild animals. If then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you seven times according to your sins. I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which will bereave you of your children and destroy your cattle and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted. Now all of these curses in the history of the nation, all of these curses were experienced before and during the Assyrian invasion. So I put together a timeline here from left to right. So let's begin the timeline from the book of Judges and Joshua when we entered the land in 1406 B.C., through the Assyrian invasions, which is approximately 745 B.C., the land had an up-and-down experience. There were some times of prosperity and righteousness, for example, under King David, but there were also times of rebellion against the Lord, like in the book of Judges. Every man did what's right in their own eyes. And so, when we entered the land, we had some periods of prosperity, but we also had periods of sickness, harassment, insecurity, drought, famine, and wild animals. So this was a time of discipline, but of mild intensity, because it was mixed in with periods of righteousness. All right, let's move on to Leviticus 26, verses 23 through 26. And the next round of curses is the horrors of siege. And if by these things you are not turned to me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with hostility against you, and I will strike you seven times for your sins. It's going to get worse if you don't repent. I will also bring upon you a sword. That's a military invasion. That's violence. I will also bring upon you a sword, which will execute vengeance for the covenant. And when you gather together into your cities, I will send pestilence among you. That's an inevitable result of siege. I will send pestilence among you so that you shall be delivered into enemy hands. When I break off your staff of bread, 10 women will break your bread in one oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts so that you will eat and not be satisfied. So the horrors of siege, war, and hunger caused by siege are promised. And these elements were experienced during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions of the land, the northern and southern kingdom. So we started out in the time of judges through the Assyrian invasions. Now let's move down our timeline. Then during the Assyrian invasions, around 745 to 722 BC, and then also during the Babylonian invasions, 605 to 582 BC, the horrors of siege were experienced. So discipline is coming in increasing intensity. This is discipline of increasing intensity, violence and starvation, hunger, and war is coming upon the land. Then in verses 27 through 33, the next round of curses is mentioned. If you still disobey me, you will experience devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. Yet, if in spite of this you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with wrathful hostility against you. And I will punish you seven times for your sins. It's gonna get even worse. Further, you will eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters you will eat. Cannibalism. I will then destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and heap your remains in the remains of your idols, for my soul shall abhor you. And I will lay waste your cities as well and make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your soothing aromas, and I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled over it. And you, however, I will scatter among the nations. The land is going to be desolate, and then it's going to be deserted, because I'm going to scatter you among the nations, and you will draw out a sword after you. Violence will follow you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste, become deserted. So devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism were experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions. So now we're going to move down the timeline a little bit. During the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions, we experienced the horrors of siege. But then, as things got worse during the Babylonian and Roman destructions, the Babylonian destruction in 586 BC, the Roman destruction in 70 AD, devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism came upon the country. In other words, this is the fullness of judgment, dispersion, out of the land. The fullness of judgment has come upon Israel on these two occasions already. Then as we get to verses 34 and 35, the state of the land during this time of exile the land is described as resting and desolate. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths, all the days of the desolation, while you're in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, it will observe the rest which it did not observe on your Sabbaths, while you were living in it. So the state of the land is resting and desolate. Again, Moses is describing the state of the land after the fullness of judgment has come. And this has been experienced twice. It's been experienced after the Babylonian and after the Roman destructions. So during the Babylonian Roman destructions, the fullness of judgment fell upon us. But let's move down the timeline again. After the Babylonian, the Babylonian period, the Babylonian exile was 586 to 516 BC. After the Babylonian and Roman destructions, the Roman destruction from 70 AD to 1948 AD, the land has been resting and desolate. The state of the land during both dispersions has been that of resting and desolate. And we have documentation of that, and the documentation comes from none other than Mark Twain in his book Innocents Abroad. Now you can read these comments on Wikipedia. The Innocents Abroad, or The New Pilgrim's Progress, is a travel book by American author Mark Twain, published in 1869, which humorously chronicles what Twain called his great pleasure excursion on board the chartered vessel Quaker City through Europe and the Holy Land with a group of American travelers in 1867. It was the best-selling of Twain's works during his lifetime and one of the best-selling travel books of all time. And you can pick up Innocence Abroad if you're interested in Innocence Abroad, you can pick it up at Amazon.com. The book is still in print, apparently. Now, what did he write? Here's what Mark Twain wrote. We traverse some miles of desolate country. Notice the word he used there, desolation. Whose soil is rich enough, but is given wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse. A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reach Tabor safely. That's Mount Tabor. We never saw a human being on the whole route. In other words, the land is deserted. So where are the Palestinians that claim to have been living there from time immemorial? Mark Twain didn't see any. They weren't there. The land was deserted. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky and bare and repulsive and dreary the landscape became. There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a mournful, dreary, and lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. And of course, that's what the land was called in those days. It was called Palestine because the Jewish people had not returned to our territory. Palestine, remember, Palestine was a name given to the land by the Romans in order to divorce Jewish presence from the land, Jewish attachment to the land. And we also have photographic attestation to what Mark Twain wrote. Here is Mount Tabor. This is a colorized black and white that was taken in the late 1800s, about the time Mark Twain was there, late 1800s. Mount Tabor, desolate and deserted. And here is Mount Carmel. Take another colorized black and white, taken about the same time. The area is desolate and deserted. And then there's Jerusalem, again, taken colorized black and white, taken the late 1800s, and it's hardly the city that it is today. So the state of the land is resting and desolate after the Babylonian and Roman destructions. Then in verses 36 through 39, the state of the people is described after the destructions. Fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. Verses 36 through 39. As for those of you who may be left, I will also bring weakness into their hearts in the lands of their enemies, and the sound of a driven leaf will chase them. And even when no one is pursuing, they will flee as though from the sword, and they will fall. They will therefore stumble over each other as if running from the sword, although no one is pursuing, and you will have no strength to stand up before your enemies. But you will perish among the nations, and your enemies' lands will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of your enemies, and also because of the iniquities of your forefathers. They will rot away with them. And so during this time of desolation, the state of the people is described, and this description of being fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted is a very apt description of the past 1800 to 2000 years. Now, an even more detailed description of this curse is found in the parallel passage, Deuteronomy 28, 15 through 68. We're not going to go there except to read just a short passage from Deuteronomy 28, verses 64 to 67. Here's what the parallel passage states. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you or your fathers have not known. Among those nations you will find no rest, and there will be no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. So your life will hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread night and day, and will have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, "Would that it were evening!" And at the evening you shall say, Would that it were morning, because of the dread of your heart, which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes, which you will see. The state of the people, fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. This was experienced after the Roman destruction. So let's go back to our time frame. So the state of the land during the exiles is resting and desolate, but as we move down our timeline, it's after the Roman destruction that the people experience this horrendous curse. We didn't experience this after the Babylonian destruction. In Babylon, we prospered. But in Europe, Eastern and Western Europe, North Africa, we were persecuted from about AD 70 to 1948 AD. And we have attestation, documentation of this experience as well from outside the Bible. This book, The Legacy of Israel, I recommend, by Bevan and Singer, on page 119 of The Legacy of Israel. This is what we read. So for centuries, the Jew lived in a constant state of alarm and often of acute suffering, never knowing but that he might be driven from his home or see it burnt over his head or be butchered by a mob of ruffians or sent wandering with wife and children to find shelter if he could, and if not, to die of starvation. There is a book in Hebrew with the significant title of Emek HaBacha, The Valley of Weeping. It gives in a series of annals the record of all the massacres known to the writer from the earliest times to his own. That's from the middle of the 16th century, was his own time. Every page of that terrible book is, as it were, soaked in blood and tears. And not the least impressive feature of the recital is the way in which the story of horror is told with a dull monotony in which all separate incidents are merged in one long agony of grief. And you can pick up The Veil of Tears by Joseph HaCohen. It's available on abebooks.com, if you want to check out this book. And we have photographic attestation to this experience as well. Here's a pogrom in Poland, 1936. That's a Jewish building going up in flames. And of course, the Nazi Holocaust of World War II. Here's that famous picture. It's been colorized. It's much more dramatic when it's colorized, isn't it? This is that famous picture of the Warsaw Ghetto, January 1943. Liberation of Dachau, 1945. And has anything changed at all today? No. There are still plenty of anti-Semites around the world today that want to see Israel destroyed. And so Israel is still experiencing one long agony of grief. The curse is still with us. But then in verses 40 through 46, a dramatic change occurs. Restoration is promised. If they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers in their unfaithfulness, which they committed against me, and also in their acting with hostility against me, I also was acting with hostility against them to bring them into the land of their enemies. Or, if their uncircumcised heart becomes humbled so that they then make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob. I will remember also my covenant with Isaac, and my covenant with Abraham as well. And I will remember the land. For the land will be abandoned by them, deserted. And I will make up for it, and will make up for its Sabbaths, while it was made desolate without them. They, meanwhile, will be making amends for their iniquity, because they rejected my ordinances, and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them. Now, I want all replacement theologians to grapple with that phrase. In the land of their enemies, I will not reject them. We are living in the land of our enemies today. That's why I'm in the United States of America. And that's why Jewish people are scattered all over the world still today. But God says, I will not reject them. In other words, God has not rejected the Jewish people. He has not cast them out of his sight forever. The church has not replaced Israel. I will not reject them in the land of their enemies. Nor will I abhor them as to destroy them, breaking my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will remember for them the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. These are the statutes and the ordinances and laws which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai. So restoration is promised, restoration from a worldwide dispersion. So let's finish up our timeline. So the state of the people from 70 AD to 1948 AD has been very dire. But then restoration and a peace and an end to suffering is promised with the institution of the Messianic Kingdom. But you notice that there's a gap in my timeline there. Some things hasn't been stated yet. Something needs to be revealed. And yes, that will be revealed later by the prophets, that this is where the Antichrist destruction, the tribulation diaspora fits, the most severe discipline of all. It will not be until that diaspora has been experienced that the Messianic Kingdom will be instituted. All right, that is the final judgment of the tribulation period, the Antichrist's dispersion. It's also called the time of Jacob's trouble. And so I'd like to add to your notes some verses that deal with the tribulation diaspora, the time of Jacob's trouble. Here's some New Covenant verses that you should be aware of dealing with this tribulation diaspora. Matthew 24:15-16. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must what? Flee to the mountains, get out of the land. And then Revelation 12:6. Then the woman, that's symbolizing Israel, fled into the wilderness. She got out of the land, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days. And then in verse 14, but the two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman, to Israel, so that she could fly into the wilderness, into the diaspora, for her place, where she would be nourished a time, times and half a time, from the presence of the serpent. So those are other indicators of the tribulation diaspora, fleeing the land during the middle of the tribulation. So we have the time period after the Roman destruction until the Antichrist destruction, and between those two time periods lies our class, the first regathering, modern Israel, after the Roman destruction, but before the Antichrist destruction occurs. All right, the next introductory topic I want to touch on is the topic called the Times of the Gentiles. Just exactly what is the Times of the Gentiles? The definition of this topic is derived from Luke 21:24. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So the times of the Gentiles is best defined as that long period of time from the Babylonian exile until the second coming of Messiah. So here's the Babylonian exile in 586 B.C., and so we're going to develop the times of the Gentiles from the Babylonian exile, when Jerusalem was trampled down, until the second coming, when Jerusalem is no longer trampled down by the Gentiles. That is the time period indicated by that title, from the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians until the freedom of Jerusalem, the salvation of Jerusalem provided by the Messiah. So during this time period, the Gentiles will be allowed to dominate the city of Jerusalem. Now, this does not rule out temporary or partial Jewish control over the city. For example, the Maccabean period or the current period. However, the times of the Gentiles will end when the Gentiles no longer tread down the city of Jerusalem. And Jewish control then will be permanent and complete. Now, there's some additional passages covering the times of the Gentiles. You could write these down, Daniel chapter 2, verses 31 to 45, Daniel 7, chapter 7, verses 1 through 28, and then in the book of Revelation, chapter 13, verses 1 through 10, and chapter 17, verses 7 through 14. So we are in the times of the Gentiles right now. Now, the evidence of this fact is the dominance of the Temple Mount by the Muslims and the fact that ownership of East Jerusalem is disputed today. Here's the Temple Mount. There's no Jewish temple on the Temple Mount. Instead, there's a Muslim mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then the Dome of the Rock, a Muslim shrine. But the Dome of the but the Jewish temple is not there. There's only partial control of Jerusalem by the Jewish people. So there is a spiritual reason why the Palestinians demand that Jerusalem be their capital city. You know, the Palestinians want full control of Jerusalem because Satan, it's a satanic desire, because Satan does not want the times of the Gentiles to come to an end. When the times of the Gentiles comes to an end, his career is over. And so there's a resistance against Jewish control over the city of Jerusalem. All fits in the same picture. Now, I'd like to talk about the principle of expansion and contraction. At this point, this principle, let me start with the question, have the Jewish people ever possessed all of the promised land? The answer is a resounding no. The greatest extent of possession occurred during the realm of King Solomon, and this map shows you King Solomon's possession of the land to its greatest extent to date. Okay? At that time, we possessed around 50 to 75% of the land. Now, let's remember back to what we learned about the Abrahamic Covenant. Two principles we previously discovered were, number one, that Jewish ownership of the land is unconditional based on the Abrahamic Covenant. We own the land no matter what. But enjoyment of the land blessing, enjoyment of the land promise, is contingent upon obedience. And now the principle of expansion and contraction comes into play. If Israel is obedient, then God will increase possession of the land to the full borders promised under the Abrahamic covenant. However, if Israel is disobedient, then God will reduce the territory that the nation enjoys and eventually cast us even out of the land, so we're not even in the land. And these principles are found, first of all, in Deuteronomy 19:8 and 9, the principle of expansion. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which he promised to give your fathers, if you carefully observe all this commandment which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and work in his ways, so blessing is based on obedience, then you shall add three more cities to yourself besides these three. In other words, the land will be expanded. You'll need three more cities of refuge. And then comes the principle of contraction. 2 Kings 10:31 to 32. But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. And he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin. In those days, the Lord began to what? Cut off portions from Israel. In other words, contract the land, contract the borders. And Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. The principle of expansion and contraction. Now, the following charts are going to illustrate how the principle of expansion and contraction has been experienced during the life of the nation. We'll start with the ancient possession of the land. And here's the chart. The first time period is a time of Abraham, where we possessed very, very little of the land, just a burial cave. And then during the time of Judges, when we entered the land, we began to conquer it, and we gained, you know, under Joshua and the Judges, we gained maybe 20% of the land. Then came the United Kingdom, and under Solomon we occupied maybe 70% of the land. And here's Solomon's kingdom. Here we see the Jewish possession of the land. Here is the kingdom of Saul, and then it expanded under righteous David. And then at the beginning of Solomon's reign, it expanded even further. So that's the greatest extent to date. But then we entered the period of the divided kingdom, and the northern kingdom was sinful, and we began to lose territory. God began to cut off territory from Israel. The Assyrian conquest, the northern kingdom was gone, or the people were gone from the northern kingdom. After the Babylonian exile, Jewish people were, for all intents and purposes, gone from the southern kingdom. But then we returned after 70 years, began to rebuild our land. During the Hellenistic period, we were back to maybe 40% of the land. And during the first century, under the Romans, we began to lose territory again. And then came the first worldwide dispersion under the Romans. We were cast out of the land one more time. We didn't possess the land. Now comes modern possession of the land. We start with the first worldwide dispersion. We're out of the land, very few Jewish people living in the land. But then the first worldwide regathering, which is the subject of our study from 1839 to 1948, we begin to buy back pieces of our land and resettle the land. After the War of Independence, we owned perhaps 30% of our land. Then after the Six-Day War, we were up to maybe 40% of our land. And that's remained pretty stable, pretty constant, through the Yom Kippur War in 73, through the Lebanon War in 1982, through the Gulf War in 1990, and then came the peace process. And we began to lose land. We lost sovereignty over the West Bank. We lost sovereignty over the Gaza Strip. Now, where will it go in the near future? I have no idea. Will we gain land or lose land? That's up to the Lord. But we do know. We do know that the second worldwide dispersion is coming in the tribulation. We will be cast out of the land one more time. And then will come the second worldwide regathering, and we will possess, eventually possess, all of the land that God has promised to us as the Messianic kingdom is instituted and as the nation of Israel grows again. All right, I'd like to start to bring this time of introduction to a close with the a chart of the chronological sequence of events. This has been documented by Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum in his book Footsteps of the Messiah, which is a study of the sequence of prophetic events. It's a study in chronology. That's why it is so useful. So he lists prophetic events that have already taken place, World War I and World War II. The reestablishment of the State of Israel and Jerusalem under Jewish control. These are all foundational events that have already occurred. Then prophetic events that have not taken place that we need to look forward to. The Russian invasion of Israel is probably next. That will be followed by one world government. And then the ten kingdoms. The one world government will split into ten kingdoms. A worldwide government, but of 10 units. From those 10 units will come the rise of the Antichrist, then a period of peace and false security, and finally a 7-year covenant signed with Israel that starts the tribulation period. So the next major prophetic event that we should expect is the Russian invasion of Israel. And then there are prophetic events that cannot be chronologically arranged. The rapture of the church, we don't know when that will happen at any moment. We don't know when the first worldwide blackout will occur. We don't know exactly when Elijah will return. And we don't know when the third temple will be constructed. So those are prophetic events to look forward to. Now, on page 35, my final introductory topic is the topic of Islam. Now, I'm not an expert on Islam, and I don't want to be an expert on Islam. However, I've included a short article in your outline to acquaint you with Islam. It's important to have an introductory knowledge of Islam when you study the history of the modern state of Israel. Islam is the most obvious persecutor of the Jewish people today, and so you need to know something about it. And please note what I am not saying. I am not saying that Islam is prophesied in the Bible or that the Antichrist is a Muslim or anything like that. I am simply supplying you with an article about Islam so you can begin to understand this preeminent enemy of the modern state of Israel. So the article is Islam, the fastest growing religion on earth. And the article appeared in SIM Now, that's Sudan Interior Mission Now. That's their newsletter or magazine. And they have a number of headings in their magazine, in this article, I should say. And the first heading is, What is Islam? So I'm going to share just excerpts from these articles. So from the section, What is Islam? We read, Angels play an important role in Islam, especially the recording angels who write down each person's good and bad deeds. Both will have to be accounted for on Judgment Day. And only those whose good deeds outweigh the bad will be admitted to heaven, if Allah wills. So this is a works religion, and there's no assurance of salvation in it. Even though you've done good works, Allah might not will that you get into heaven. Okay, again, a works religion, no assurance of salvation. On the Messiah's crucifixion. Of Christ's crucifixion, death, and resurrection, the Quran says, they killed him not, nor crucified him, but so it was made to appear to them. So the crucifixion, death, and resurrection are just a facade. They killed him not. Nay, God raised him up unto himself, and God is exalted in power. Why? So the crucifixion and resurrection is untrue, just a myth. Muslims believe that Jesus will return to earth in the last days as a Muslim, marry, have children, die, and be buried near Muhammad. So he's just a man, basically. And then on the Trinity, on the triune nature of God, the Quran teaches, say not three, refrain. Better it is for you. God is only one God. So they don't believe in the biblical description of Yeshua, the resurrection, crucifixion, resurrection, and death of Yeshua, the nature of God, some very basic things. They're very different in the Quran. Now, another important segment of Muslim belief is jihad, or holy war against the opponents of Islam. Those who die in jihad bypass the Day of Judgment and go directly to paradise. They go directly to paradise. And this, of course, is the foundation for Islamic terrorism today. Many of these guys become terrorists because they want to go directly to heaven, to be guaranteed heaven. This is their way of assurance of salvation, by being a terrorist, by dying in a war, a holy war against the opponents of Islam. That's the foundation of it right there. All right. Now, under the section about Muhammad and the expansion of Islam, we read, one night, after months of meditation on Mount Hira, 40-year-old Muhammad suddenly became aware of a presence. Moments later, he was caught up in a revelation that would prove to be the primal spark of the Islamic religion. There are indications that at first he thought he had been enveloped by an evil spirit. Shaken by this experience, he went home to his first wife, Khadija, who wrapped him in a blanket and persuaded him that he had not been possessed. This was written by George Otis Jr. in The Last of the Giants. The messages from this and subsequent visitations became what is today the Quran and Muhammad, the prophet of Allah. So that's the basis of Islam. So read that article, and that article should give you some insight into the nature of Islam. At this point, I'd like to share some rabbinic thoughts about the modern state of Israel. These thoughts come from a book, The Talmudic Anthology, by Lois I. Newman, and again, it's available on Amazon.com. The rabbis have some interesting statements to make. I'll just share four of them. In Menachot 53, we read, why is Israel like an olive? As the olive gives its oil only by being crushed, so does Israel repent only through chastisements. So there we see the principle that curses of the covenant is supposed to bring Israel to repentance. This is understood in Menachot 53. Netharim 49, Israel is like a vine. A vine is trodden underfoot, but later its wine is placed on the table of the king. So too does Israel, at first oppressed, come to greatness. So Israel is first oppressed in this world, but then the Messianic kingdom will be instituted and she will come to greatness. That's what they're mentioning there. That's what they're seeing there. Sanhedrin 104, those who persecute Israel are unwearying. Oh, and that is so true today. Just a relentless and unwearying. That's because Satan is relentless and unwearying. And then in Esther Rabbah 6:5, as the myrtle is sweet to him who smell it, but bitter to him who bites into it, so Israel brings prosperity to the nation that grants him kindness and depression to the people who afflicts them with evil. And so that's another way of saying, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you, the Abrahamic covenant. Well, let me close this section with some thoughts of application. First of all, always remember that Zionism is not subjective. Zionism is backed by objective biblical support. If you're a Zionist, I would suggest that you defend the Jewish right to the land from the scriptures that we've looked at. Defend the Jewish right to the land and the idea of a Jewish national home from the biblical support I presented. All other arguments contain a limited amount of clout. All other arguments are simply man's social, political, and economic reasons. And man's social, political, and economic reasoning changes as easily as the breeze. It's here today and gone tomorrow. But the Word of God, in contrast, is a firm anchor that can never be moved. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Men's reasons are like grass and flowers, here today and gone tomorrow. But God and His revelation are rocks, mountains we can utterly depend on. So Zionism and the Jewish return to our homeland are important ingredients in the plan of God for this world. All right, I'm going to close now with a theological summary. Here's a theological summary of our first section here. I'm going to ask the question, why the unending struggle in the Middle East? And there are five factors in play. First of all, there is a religious war going on, Islam versus the Bible, Islamic paganism versus biblical truth. Secondly, there's a personal war going on, Satan versus God. Satan is desperately trying to save himself. When the Abrahamic covenant is fulfilled, his career is over. He will be cast into his final abode, the lake of fire. Thirdly, the Abrahamic covenant is in effect. There are promises made to the Jewish people. If the Abrahamic covenant can be perverted or prevented from being fulfilled, then God is shown to be a liar because he can't keep his promises. He's shown to be weak. And Satan's career is safe. He can accuse God. See, the glory of God is wrapped up in the Abrahamic covenant. The character of God is a fundamental component of the Abrahamic covenant. Fourthly, the discipline of the Mosaic covenant is in play due to Jewish disobedience. We're suffering the curses of the covenant today because we're not an obedient people. And now this generates a common question. I get asked, if the Mosaic covenant is no longer in effect, why are the curses on Israel still operating? Well, the Mosaic covenant has been rendered inoperative for those of us who've accepted Yeshua as Savior and live under the new covenant. However, the unbelieving Israel as a nation has not yet entered into the new covenant. Individual Jews like myself have, but not the nation as a whole. That awaits the end of the tribulation and the fulfillment of Romans 11:25-29 when all Israel is saved. The new covenant is embraced by grace through faith, and so all Israel will do that. And as a result, the Mosaic covenant is still the rule of life for unbelieving Israel. Therefore, the blessings and cursings of the covenant are still in effect for unbelieving Israel today. And finally, fifthly, prophecy must be fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles must be fulfilled. Jerusalem will be trodden down until Yeshua returns and the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. All right, that brings us to the end of our introductory section. As we look at our table of contents, we've finished up section one, the spiritual war, the introduction, and we'll start into section two, the background, the historical survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839 AD. We'll start that our next session. All right, thanks for being our students. I hope this introductory material has biblically blessed you and helped in your discipleship and your walk with the Lord. And we'll see you next session as we look more now, as we begin to focus in on the history of the modern state of Israel. Again, thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lehitra'ot. Lehitra'ot.